You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on Right on Radio, Liz talks with Janice Post White about her memoir, Standing at Water's Edge. It's her story about working as a cancer nurse who thought she knew what life and death were about until her four-year-old son got leukemia. This heart-wrenchingly real but inspiring book shines a light on the life-affirming discoveries that can be made when one is forced to face death and bravely choose to face fears. Then, the last part of the hour, we do a deep dive into the Right on Radio past, playing one of our very special legacy interviews. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Welcome to Right on Radio. I'm Liz Olds, and I'm going to be interviewing Janice Post White, author of Standing at Water's Edge, a book about her son having leukemia and her journey through that. So welcome, Janice. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Great. Thank you very much, Liz, for inviting me.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for coming. We appreciate people who come in on Tuesday evenings to share their time with us. Why don't you start with description of the book, but why don't you start with a little bit more description of the book?
Okay. Well, it is a story about a cancer nurse who becomes a cancer mom when her four-year-old son is diagnosed with leukemia. And the most important thing is he survives, and yet she dreams of his death, which forces her to face her fears or be haunted by them forever. And it's a memoir, of course, so the story is my story. When Brennan was 4 years old, he was diagnosed with leukemia, and I was a cancer nurse, researcher, and an educator at the university. So I knew what to expect regarding treatment options, side effects, and how to navigate the healthcare system, but I had no training as a cancer mom. Mm. And that's what I struggled with. How do I be a nurturing mom when my natural tendency is to solve problems, get them in treatment, and advocate for my son and make decisions? And I felt responsible for both guiding him and my family through that 3 years of treatment. So I did what I knew best. I buried my feelings and flew into action. Well, Brennan, meanwhile, drew pictures. The first day in the hospital, he asked for paper and colors and wanted to share what he was feeling. And so while I buried, he drew, and many of those pictures are in the book. The first one that I always like to talk about is so poignant, is that he's a little yellow bird. He doesn't say he's the little yellow bird, but he says there's no way to get in. There's no windows or doors, and it's hiding in the attic of a house with a warning to stay away. And then the next day, he draws the same little yellow bird with polka dots all over him, indicating the number of pokes that he's had. And then he whispers to me and said, "Now you can get in the window, Mom." So he let me in, but it was very revealing on how he processed his emotions through the journey while I buried mine. And after 3 years of treatment, he survived, and we take up our protective armor and reclaim our childhood as best we can. But a decade later, I had dreams that he died. Wow. And it was just, the memories had just weaseled their way into my DNA, and I remained hypervigilant. And that's when I realized I had to face my fears, or they'd haunt me forever. So I started writing this book. And I guess the most important thing I learned is that how important it is to reflect on how illness shapes our lives and reframes our priorities.
Do you have a little reading for us? Do you have a little reading for us that you can do?
Say it again.
Do you have a little reading for us that you could do from the book?
Oh, yes, I do. I'll start with chapter one. which starts on a day of diagnosis, which is January 9th, 1997, 2:40 p.m. Gwendolyn lay stretched out high atop the pediatrician's oak examining table. Even at age 4 and a half, he reached across the entire leg, half reclining on his left side, facing me, perhaps watching me. He leaned on his left elbow and tossed every few seconds to reposition away the pain in his thin, long legs. "Hi, Brennan. Back again?" the nursing assistant said as she walked in, set down a tray of supplies, swiped his finger with a pungent alcohol swab, and pricked his middle finger with a tiny lancet. He watched, as if observing a science experiment, as the red drops defied gravity and rose up the capillary tube. He didn't cry. After the assistant wrapped on a miniature Donald Duck Band-Aid, I asked if she could tell me what his lab results were from his last visits 2 weeks earlier. "I didn't bring them in," I said. She nodded and went out to check for me. Moments later, she slipped in and quietly closed the door behind her. She hesitated and then recited. His white count was 6.5 and his hemoglobin was 8.6. 8.6, I said, composed but incredulous. I knew that his white count was fine, but normal values for hemoglobin were at least 12 to 13 grams per deciliter. Anything lower meant anemia. A hemoglobin below 9 was serious. I looked straight into her eyes as the nurse and me tamped down the rising panic of a mother's worst fears. "Why weren't we told?" She gave a sympathetic shrug and dashed out of the room. I stared at the closed door. I wouldn't let myself consider the significance of the low value, so I focused on the lack of disclosure. Anger was easier to face than fear. Why hadn't they told Lori, our nanny, who had brought him in the day before Christmas? I'm certain she would have told me. Did they think it might be an error? I was afraid to believe it could be real. I tried to breathe, to stay in the moment, ignoring the diseases, shouting their textbook headlines. Just that morning, I had considered infectious disease. I couldn't imagine a common virus causing sporadic fevers and intermittent pain. All I could do was wait for the new results. I stood next to Brennan, my hands gently resting on his legs. I took a deep breath and asked, "How are you doing?" "Okay," he said with a blank expression. I'd like to imagine that I was channeling energy from the universe to help his body heal, or at least to disperse the pain in his legs and give him strength to tolerate it. I wanted my touch to reassure him, to tell him that I was there for him. I wanted to be present for him, as I envisioned a concerned mother might be, thinking about how he must feel. Instead, my nurse mind churned with uncertainty, collecting and sorting the ambiguous facts and data, trying to tessellate the events of the past 2 months into some coherent picture.
That's Janice Post-White from Standing at Water's Edge, a book about her son's journey through leukemia and her journey through leukemia, too. I'm curious if you would talk a little bit about Brennan and Tyler before the diagnosis and, you know, what they were like and what they like to do and so on, so that we can get a picture of these young men.
Well, as many children are in a family, they're very different. Brennan was the oldest, and he loved sports. We teased that he came out of the room dribbling the ball. Anything with a hand-ball coordination, Brennan was active, busy, constantly talking and engaging and asking questions. And Tyler was the quiet one. He was a follower, but a very astute observer. And so through the process of all the leukemia, I think their characteristics were amplified into who the what the personality underlying was.
What was Brennan's first reaction to finding out that he had leukemia? Was he scared? Was he numb? What was his first reaction?
It's a little hard to know because he hid his emotions at first. Mm-hmm. And I remember just that afternoon, I brought him home from the doctor's office, and then we, you know, packed a bag and got him in the car to go, and he strapped in the back seat, and he asked me, "So what's the plan, Mom?" That was his first reaction. What's going to happen? You know, and it actually wasn't until the next morning at the hospital that when my husband, when his dad told him more about what leukemia was. I was so busy doing, I didn't even stop to talk to him about it. It was just a matter of getting this kid an IV and getting fluid started, getting everything, you know, ready to go. I was busy taking care of all the details. It was my husband who said, hey, let me tell you a little bit about it. So Brennan was stoic, and he didn't talk about it much. He just, you know, did what he was told to do. And then later on, he's also, years later, he told me, as a four-year-old, I did what I had to do. That's all I knew.
And what was, well, it sounds like your reaction was to become mom nurse, but talk more about that, how you navigated that, being a nurse and being a mom at the same time.
Well, that was probably the hardest part for me, and it was only, being a nurse was so much easier. I've studied patients with cancer. I knew what to expect. It was so much easier with my nurse hat on. I tell you, living with cancer is a lot harder than studying it, and that's why I wrote the book, is you've got to pay attention to your feelings and your emotions, and I guess the bottom line is I learned to live with my heart as well as my head. And that's what I learned. I had to learn how to be a nurturing mom and be there for my son, not for my son as a cancer patient. And it took some reminders from my kids, and it took the process of thinking through and reflecting on what the experience meant before it really came to light for me.
Brennan went into a special treatment protocol, correct?
Well, he's in a clinical trial.
Okay.
And it was standard treatment for someone diagnosed with B-cell ALL, which is what he had, and there was only one clinical trial available. And we had the choice whether to put him on it or not, and we chose to. Because there aren't very many children diagnosed per year around the world. These clinical trials are all across the United States as well as around the world. It took 5 years to get 2,000 kids in this trial. So they usually only test one trial at a time. And that's what he followed. But because he was in a clinical trial, we had to follow the quote-unquote roadmaps of the trial.
And what were some of those roadmaps?
Well, they were monthly plans of, you know, little tiny print of what you did, what day, and what drug you got, and why. And it's for someone not familiar with the clinical trial, it's very prescribed. And when you vary from it, you have to have a reason. And like if his counts go low, his white count or his hemoglobin went low, then you had to cut back on the doses. And the clinical trial spells it all out for you. So that the first 11 months were the most intense part of the treatment, and then he goes into maintenance phase as long as his bone marrow biopsy showed that he had less than 95% blast, which for him it did. So we followed that treatment plan for 3 years and 2 months, although we made a couple of modifications along the way because of complications, which is pretty standard practice.
I would imagine some of these treatment, like bone marrow thing, would hurt quite a bit. How did Brennan go through that pain?
Well, at our institution and at many, when the kids are that young, they sedate them. And that's what they did. Now, today, there's a little controversy over whether it's all that healthy to give them all that propofol every week or every month. And then eventually it was every 3 months. But I don't know. He's a strong kid, but what he hated worse was the swirling tornado, he called it, of the propofol. And that's what he remembers most about the experience. Whenever you asked him after the fact, it was that swirling tornado of dizziness that he hated getting ready for the biopsies and the aspirations, and they have to get intrathecal chemotherapy into their spine in order to prevent central nervous system relapse. And so that was hard for him. Now, the teenagers and the older kids, often they get conscious sedation and some Versed or something like that. But a long time ago, we just used distraction, you know, blowing bubbles and reading them a story. And,
then
I really did have to endure the pain.
Wow.
Hard to go through it with those little kids, especially.
Oh, yeah. Especially with that pain. I've had a little spine stuff myself, and it does hurt. It hurts. I can't imagine what it's like to be 4 years old and to have to be going through that.
Well, and repeatedly. That's the hard part. It's just over and over and over. And then, you know, at first he didn't know, and then afterward, he, you know, as soon as my husband picked him up to take him down the elevator, he'd kick and scream and fight us. You know, he knew exactly what was going to happen, and that's what was hard for him.
And it must have been hard for you, too. I mean, I know you fell into your nurse-ness to cope with some of it, but it also must have been hard to see your son in so much pain and dealing with so many issues around this cancer.
It was, and that's when I kind of would revert to my nurse hat and say, this has to be done. This is, you know, you just kind of justify it. We just have to get through this. And that whole first part of the book is about getting through and living in the dark. And you just have to find a way, both emotionally and physically, to get through it, because he won't survive if you don't. You know, it's 100% fatal if you don't go through some form of aggressive chemotherapy treatment. So, you know, you do that to save your son. That's a trade-off. And you just kind of kept that in my mind, you know. And then you try to, you know, be as supportive and understanding, and you try to reduce all those symptoms and side effects as much as you can and be there for him. But I would think having a teenager would be hard, because they would also be in the rebellious stage, you know, and talking back stage, you know. So every age has its unique issues.
When did you feel like you finally came to grips with your own need for care, whether it was, you know, your own emotional care, perhaps your husband caring for you, or, you know, how did you know finally that you were in a state that you needed to be helped to?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it's a continuum. It's not, that's what was surprising about the dream 10 years off treatment is, oh my gosh, you know, when I actually dreamt he died, it was that sudden realization that I guess I didn't process this. I guess I'm not okay with all of this. Well, all along, my head overrode my mind, my heart. You know, my mind overrode my heart and said, you got this. We can move on. Coming off treatment was a huge event. It's a huge transition. You're so relieved. But it's also taking away what we call a chemo blankie. It's our security against relapse. So I think really it was 5 years off treatment when I could breathe a sigh of relief and relax a little bit. And that's also when Tyler passed the four-year mark. And I could say, okay, some siblings, I know some families who both of their kids get cancer. Both of them get leukemia. So that was a huge release for me, I think, both when Brennan was 5 years off treatment and when Tyler turned 5 years old. And then just kind of, you know, we went back to our life as much as we could and tried to focus on the joy and living every moment. And so it was a surprise when the dream woke me up, and that's when I realized I hadn't processed these feelings very thoroughly in a way that I could let them go. And then what I learned is you have to feel those feelings before you can let them go.
Yeah.
You can't just process them from a cognitive level. You have to feel them.
They say the only way out is through.
Exactly.
Talk about Brennan's drawings. He really seems to get a lot of help from his drawings.
Yeah, he did. And I talked about the house
and the bird.
And then he actually colored a picture of his bones, and he told me he put a heart in with his bones. He told me there's a heart and a brain because you need both, Mom. And then later he told me that he gave the bones the right cells, because that's where your leukemia starts. Leukemia starts in the bone marrow. And you need to have the, you know, the cells, and what he had is, you know, 98% immature white blood cells, which is not the balance you want. So he filled it in with more platelets and red blood cells, and that told me that he kind of grasped the whole idea of it. But then the other one I like to talk about is he loved the story of the Headless Horseman getting lost in the dark. And I just, like, I couldn't figure out why he liked that dark story so much. But we read it many night after night. And one day he brings me a picture and he says, "Here's a picture for you, Mom." And I asked him what it was. And he said, "I drew him a candle. I gave the Headless Horseman a candle to help him find his way." And later on, he drew sailboats. And I had no idea he had any connection to sailboats. Dwayne and I had taken sailing lessons before the kids were born in the Boston Harbor on the East Coast. And he drew several sailboats. And often he was either sailing alone or he had a lighthouse the boat was sailing toward. And one of them, he had a sailboat, and there was a sun, but it was behind the clouds and the lightning and the rain and the hail. And then another picture that he drew reflected that same chaos in his life was a flower. In between, in the summer, about 6 months after diagnosis, we had a little break called interim maintenance, and things were a little bit lighter for 2 months. And one day he came up to me in the morning and gave me a folded up piece of paper, like a fan, folded like a fan, and I unfolded it, and it was a picture of a flower, tall and straight, and it was grounded in the ground, even though there was rain and thunder and lightning and everything around it. And I saw that as representing him growing tall and flourishing despite all the chaos. Mm-hmm. He was centered. He was there. So he drew pictures that whole first year. And then after that, he transitioned out. He didn't draw as much after that first year. And then later on, he started writing. And he started writing for school, little essays and poignant little things about what cancer meant to him. And so eventually he transitioned to words from the pictures. But the pictures told a lot about where he was emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about Tyler. I'm curious for our listeners how to assist a younger sibling whose older sibling, who he probably looks up to a great deal, has cancer, and the young one has to deal with this in some emotional way, has to take care of himself, and you have to take care of him as well.
That's a really good question. And, you know, there's so little literature on siblings. I had a pediatric oncology nurse student, graduate student, who wanted to study siblings. And I remember telling her one day, I said, you know, I need to learn more about pediatric oncology. I was predominantly an adult oncology nurse. And that year, Brennan was diagnosed. Well, that isn't the way I wanted to learn about pediatric oncology, I'll tell you. But so I learned a lot from her about siblings. But you live through it, and every sibling is different. And Tyler was only 21 months old. I mean, I had no frame of reference. I didn't even tell him what was going on until my nanny said one day, "What have you told Tyler? Brennan's been in the hospital for 2 or 3 days." And I go, "Oh, my gosh. I mean, he's pre-verbal. He didn't ask questions. He was quiet, but he was observant, and he was withdrawn." And so I sat him down on the couch and said, you know, very simply, "Brennan's in the hospital. He has leukemia. He's sick, but they're taking really good care of him, and we hope he'll come home soon." And then he just melted into my arms.
Aww.
He needed to be told. And then I was like, oh, my gosh, I should have seen this earlier. And so many days in a row, I ended up holding him, and he just clung to me. I mean, that's his way of expressing himself. He clung to me. I took a shower with him one day because he wouldn't let go of me, and I had to get to the hospital. So the rain was coming down on all of us, you know. And over time, he adapted and kind of got in the flow of things. But years later, we're looking through pictures of when Brennan was on treatment, and he points to one of him and Brennan, and the one of them in the bathtub, and goes, "Who's that, Mom?" He didn't recognize Brennan, and he didn't remember anything, of course, of that whole experience. And then when he was in college, he did a paper on siblings of cancer survivors, and he could hardly find any research at all. And so I don't think he was very satisfied. We talked a little bit about his experience, but he didn't share a whole lot because he didn't remember a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but it does affect them.
Yeah, yes, it does, I'm sure. Talk about Brennan. After he became well again, he did some speaking at some speeches that you gave, and it sounds like you were very proud of him, and as well you should be. And talk about those speeches.
Well, I'm trying to remember which came first, but he did. We talked several times, and we gave a keynote at a pediatric oncology conference in Phoenix, and he loved being up on stage. Actually, the first time he came up on stage, he didn't talk, but I gave a keynote in San Francisco, and that's when I did a talk for oncology nurses on Wind Behind the Sales and the power that they had to help families get through cancer. And I couldn't get the kid out of bed when he got off the plane. He wanted to just crawl into the bed. And I, just on the spur of the moment, I said, hey, you want to come up on stage? And he leaped out of bed and ran to the convention center. That was his thing. So then I thought, well, he did like to talk and he did prepare. We talked in Washington, D.C. because it was his birthday. And they invited me to come and do a talk for Integrative Medicine Conference. And I said, I can't. It's Brennan's birthday. I need to be home. And then a friend of mine told the conference committee, well, Brennan talks too. So they invited him, but he stole the whole show. And they got up, there were 1,200 people in the audience, and they all got up. And started out saying, I'm 8 years old, today's my birthday, and I just finished treatment for leukemia. And they all got up and sang happy birthday to him. And he just stood up on stage, unseated, he stood up on stage and took it all in and then went on with his little talk. So he loved the limelight. And he's a good speaker, and he's got a very strong voice. He always has.
You must be very proud of him having done that.
Just to be able to even want to do it.
Yeah, really. we are running out of time here. So very quickly, what's next?
What's next in terms of what?
Writing.
Oh, well, this is all about, it's about my journey, my emotional journey, but it's about Brennan's physical journey. My next writing is about living with chronic illness and acute life-threatening illness. And it's some of the similar themes, but it's from more of an adult perspective and managing how to get through and how to make sense of and find meaning and purpose in however illness reshapes our lives.
Well, thank you very much, Janice Post White, author of Standing at Water's Edge, a cancer nurse, her 4-year-old son, and the shifting tides of leukemia. We've really enjoyed having you with us tonight. Thank you very much, and take care.
Thank you very much, Liz, and KFAI.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
He was one of the chatty passengers, the type who wanted to be my pal, my best pal ever, just my luck. I usually work security at the club on Saturday nights, but with Fredo at his sister's wedding and our substitute driver out sick, I had to drive. For my first year on the job as the night shift courtesy van driver for the Paragon Hotel, I hated guys like this, the compulsive talkers who dealt with their anxieties about flying or being near New York City or being away from the wife and kids by making nice to the poor schmuck who drove the 3-stop route between Long Island MacArthur Airport, the hotel, and the Long Island Railroad Station at Ronkonkoma. And this guy had it bad. He was a determined sort. So, hey, what's your name anyway? Gus. So, Gus, huh? What's that short for? August? Gustav? Unusual names, either one. I nodded, not bothering to tell him that Gus was an abbreviated version of my middle name, Augustus. What for? This wasn't an actual conversation. It was verbal smoke that would waft away and disperse into nothingness the moment I unloaded his bags and turned him over to the new night clerk for registration.
Very good. That is Reed Farrell Coleman reading from his new novel, What You Break, the second in his Gus Murphy series. And that the first one was Where It Hurts. He is the author of 25 novels, including the critically acclaimed Mo Prager series, and has won the Seamus, Barry, and Anthony Awards. He also writes the Jesse Stone series for the late Robert B. Parker, and he's been on the show before. Reed Farrell Coleman, welcome back to Write on Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
I really like Gus Murphy. I think he's my favorite character of the people that you write. I'm not really sure why I like him more than, say, Mo Prager or your other protagonists, but I assume you really like him as well, and talk a little bit about him and why you wanted to write him.
I actually do like Gus a lot, because one of the reasons I like Gus a lot is because he isn't like me. Mo Prager, for all of my protestations to the contrary, was me. You know, a sort of idealized version of me.
Mm-hmm.
Gus is not me. Gus is an interesting character in that he was once somebody else, and now he's becoming someone new. And the thing that changed his life was his 20-year-old son died playing a pickup basketball game, and Gus went from being someone who knew who he was, who was sure he understood how the universe worked, to a man who thought he understood nothing about anything. And so we pick up his story in Where It Hurts 2 years after his son's death. And now we've moved on a few months past that in Where and What You Break.
Mm-hmm. And was that the reason why you wanted to write Gus? I mean, you had Mo Prager, a retired New York cop, and now you've got Gus Murphy as a retired New York cop. And you had this successful series going, and yet you decided to, even though you were going to kind of keep a somewhat similar sort of mystery structure, to go off in a different direction with Gus? Was it just because you were sort of tired of writing about yourself, maybe, and wanted to write something else, or was there some other reason behind it?
Well, I don't think writers ever get tired of writing about themselves. I had said everything I had to say through Mo.
Mm.
And the fact is that Mo, in the series, there's 9 books. And the series, the Mo Prager books, start with Walking the Perfect Square. Mo is in his early 30s.
Mm.
By the time the 9th book, The Hollow Girl, came around, Mo was in his 60s, in his mid-60s. And as I say in the books, the only thing Mo could flash with any credibility at that age was his ARP card. So it was tough for me to write a hard-boiled detective novel with a guy who was 65 years old. I mean, I'm in my 60s,
yeah.
So it's not like it's ageism. I just wasn't willing to send him down to Boca Raton and have him become like the old-age detective.
Sure.
I had said everything I had to say through Mo.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the story before we go too much further. Give us a sense of the plot without giving too much away, of course.
Well, okay. So Gus is coming out of the grief period. I mean, it's been a very long grief period, and he's starting to live again a little bit. He's got a girlfriend. He's got a close friend who he works with, and he has an old friend named Father Bill, who is a priest who's left the priesthood. And Gus and Father Bill asked Gus to help out a mutual acquaintance whose granddaughter has been brutally murdered. And the twist is, the gentleman who hires Gus, he's not really interested in who did it, because the police actually have who did it. He's interested in why. And the person who's under arrest absolutely refuses to talk about why he murdered this girl. Well, that's the one of the main plots, and I don't want to go on too much about that.
Sure.
And his friend, his one really close friend in the world, Slava, with whom he works, is now in his past is caught up with him. And Gus is trying to tread water while he tracks down the information, the person who hired him about the granddaughter's murder, and tries to save Slava from his past.
Yeah.
But I can't say too much more.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And you sort of hint at Slava's past in the prior book in Where It Hurts, where he knows some things that a night bellman should not know, and he's very handy with a cosh and a gun. And so one of the things that Gus talks about in the story is that basically nobody who works at the Paragon, is it? Is it that the name of the hotel?
Yes, the Paragon Hotel.
Yeah. Yes. Almost none of these people are who they seem to be. They all have pasts.
Right. In fact, I think I wrote that they work at night to hide their past.
Yeah.
Hide their past.
Yeah, right. You also have this Father Bill character, and he's a big part, and then Dr. Rosen, who you say has sort of helped save Gus's life along with Father Bill. We don't get much of Dr. Rosen, but we get an awful lot of Father Bill. Talk a little bit about him, because he's interesting. He was a priest, and then he has left the priesthood, and he was a priest while he didn't have faith, and now he does have faith.
Yes, it's amazing how you come up with characters who won't go away. I know you've interviewed lots of writers, and I'm sure I'm not the first writer to tell you that I wrote a character who said, "You're not getting rid of me so fast." And Father Bill was that character. In the original draft of the first novel in Where It Hurts, Father Bill appeared on like page 200, and I thought, oh, this is an interesting character, a guy who used to be a priest, who was still a priest when Gus's son died, but who has an interesting backstory. And you know what? I rewrote the whole novel because I thought this character is way too interesting a character to introduce on page 200. And so Bill is an interesting guy because he served as a padre or a chaplain in Vietnam, where he lost his faith. And many, many, many years later, he finds his faith. And when he finds his faith again, he realizes he doesn't need the trappings of the church to reinforce his faith.
Yeah.
And I think that makes for an interesting character.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I think of, for example, Mother Teresa, who struggled with doubt her whole life, basically. It's certainly, near the end of her life, and put that into her journals, and yet remained a nun all the way through, and intended for her journals to be burned, and then, of course, people didn't respect her wishes. But that's something that Gus struggles with throughout the course of the story as well. He doesn't believe, but you get the sense that he really kind of wants to believe.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that struggle, though I'm not sure how many admit to it, that they don't believe, but man, I mean, I don't believe, but I would love to believe. Wouldn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be crazy not to want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. And Gus struggles with it. And don't forget, cops have a different struggle. They see people at their worst. And if they stay on the job a long time, they see that people at their worst for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard for them to believe, like Mother Teresa, who was dealt with the poorest and the lowest of the low and their horrible situations. You want to believe, but the very milieu you work in makes it hard to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
You also set this on Long Island, as you did the previous novel. And one of the things that you do that strikes me, because you come back to it over and over again, is the inequality of the income divide on Long Island. Talk a little bit about that, because Gus remarks on it, but he doesn't seem to be particularly judgmental about it. It's more just observations of the way the world is.
Well, as an author, and as a reader and a moviegoer and a TV viewer, I despise preaching. I don't like when a show or a book preaches to me. But I do like people pointing things out to me. So I guess I carry that prejudice into my writing. Mm. Gus is a guy who drove a prowl car for 20 years. He's seen a lot of things. He's lived on Long Island his whole life. He sees things, but it's not for him to judge. And I drove a home heating oil delivery truck for 7 years on and off. Mm. And you know, people, when they think of Long Island, what do they think of? They think of the Hamptons. They think of the Gold Coast. They think of the wineries. They think of yachts and golf courses and country clubs and Long Island Sound. But that's not the Long Island I live on. When I delivered home heating oil, there were people who had to choose week to week whether to have heat or food.
Mm.
So I think I wanted to introduce that Long Island where people actually live, you know, a few miles this side or that side of the Long Island Expressway. Not the Hamptons is not Long Island any more than Fifth Avenue is really what New York City is about.
Mm, yeah, right. You have a character from the previous book that is now Gus's girlfriend, too, Maggie, who we were introduced to in Where It Hurts. And we weren't sure while we were reading that if it was going to be her or it was going to be this other woman that Gus had had dinner with once or twice and hooked up with. And then, of course, he's still dealing with his ex-wife in Annie. And they have a decision to make about whether to keep the house that their son grew up in. And so talk a little bit about that dynamic of why he has gone to Maggie and how he is trying to move on by not... He talks about that at one point in the story, about not hooking up with this other woman who was a really good cook and stuff because he wasn't the same person that he used to be.
Yeah, well... You know, you asked me before about why I stopped writing Moe and why I liked writing Gus, and this relates.
Hmm.
Moe was always who he was. He was born a kind of cynical New York Jewish guy. He was always that guy. He was born that guy, and he would die that guy. Gus, on the other hand, was a guy who wasn't very cynical, even though he worked as a cop for 20 years. He thought he knew how the world operated. He understood he had what he always wanted. You know, he had a beautiful wife, a house, two kids. He had it all. And then that all went away. So the foundation, it was as if the foundation of his house got blown up with him still in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is not that guy anymore. And I think as he remarks is, The woman who he met and had dinner with and hooked up with once or twice is the kind of woman he would have once loved to be with. But he's not that person anymore. And Maggie much more suits who he is becoming than who he was.
Right.
And I think that's... And I think if you've been married to somebody for a long time... There and you're connected through your children, there's no escaping that ever.
Mm.
So, you know, he's an interesting character in that he's evolving, and even I don't know who he'll be.
Yeah. That's another question that I was going to ask you, so this is a good time to talk about it, is how much of Gus Murphy did you know writing the first novel, and how much more did you learn writing the second one? I mean, do you... Because I've written series as well, a series as well, and
some things you sort of know automatically. This is who this person is, and this is where he's going. But then, as you're writing, sometimes in book two or book three or book four, you find out, you know, he's also this, and I hadn't really thought about that before. But he's also this. Does that affect you as well?
Oh, absolutely. I like to think of myself as a very open writer, open to what the characters have to tell me about themselves. I mean, I really did rewrite the first book so you can imagine. I saw Father Bill at page 200 and rewrote the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with Gus, I'm very open to Gus telling me where he's going.
Mm-hmm.
I have a sense of who he's going to become. And how he'll get there, but I don't know for sure. And like you say, it's in the writing.
Mm.
And I'm not an outliner. I don't do story arcs. I just start with an idea and a sense of where I'm going, and I let myself go.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to work, and I do that as well. I don't really like to outline because I don't want to be sort of trapped into a bubble that I decide isn't a legitimate or honest bubble. If a character starts to do or something that the character needs to do, and then you're either stuck changing your outline or working outside of what you feel is honest communication.
Outlines have never worked for me because for two reasons. One is I feel once I've written it down, I feel committed to it.
Mm.
And secondly, if I've written it down, why would I want to write it again?
Yeah, right. And I assume then that you're also one of these writers who sort of feels like character is more important than story.
I used to think it was character alone.
Mm.
But, you know, you can have the most interesting character in the world, but if your plot is weak, it shows.
Yeah.
You have to have... You know, you can be the best-looking, fittest person in the world, but if I take your skeleton away from you, you're going to collapse into a puddle. So plot is important to me. It's become increasingly important to me over the course of my career, but a good plot enhances your character.
Mm.
So I think they go hand in hand. I used to be character, character, character. Now I see the value of a good plot.
Yeah, yeah. And you've done poetry, too. So you like to play with language, and you've talked about that before on the show. I assume that a book like this, as opposed to, say, when you're writing the Jesse Stone series, gives you a bit more freedom to play with language and really use it to drive a point home, whereas in one of the Robert B. Parker books, you're much more having to sort of stay within, to a degree, the confines that have been set up by Bob, and not do too much in the way of improvisational jazz, so to speak, on the page.
Yeah. Don't look for lyricism from me in a Jesse Stone book. And it's not because I wouldn't want to do it. It's not my series, really. I'm honoring Bob by doing it. Now, I don't write like Bob, and I don't try to write like Bob, but Jesse acts like Jesse, Suit acts like Suit, Molly acts like Molly. It is third person, which makes, for me, lyricism a little more difficult. And it's just not, I don't think that's what the readers want in those books. And unlike in my books, which I write for me and hope other people like them,
mm-hmm.
in Jesse Stone books, I do keep the audience in mind when I write those books. I have to. They're not mine. I'm doing a job for somebody, mm-hmm. and that makes a difference. And I'd be irresponsible not to do that.
Yeah. Another thing that you write, and this is very late in the book, but I don't think it's really giving anything away, Gus makes a point and says that he talks about his morality as a set of rationalizations that let him sleep at night, and partly that's because he makes certain choices that he's not sure are the right choices, but he makes them because he has faith in, believes in certain people, and therefore you know, commits to doing things in the future that might not be for the best. That's interesting to me, that here's a character who's flawed enough to sort of realize I may not always be able to do the right thing because I have committed to these people in my life.
It's interesting you bring that up, because really that is at the center of this book. And I can tell you briefly where that comes from, if you're interested.
Sure, sure.
Early in my career, I mean, at the very first beginnings in 1991, when my first two books were published, I did some book signings with a retired New York City detective named Lou Eppolito, who had written a book called Mafia Cop. And Lou was very nice to me. He was very gracious. He was very welcoming. And, you know, we weren't friends, but he was nice to me. As it turned out, Lou and his partner have since been convicted of murdering seven people. Mm-hmm. And one, the wrong person, on behalf of the New York mob. And they're both serving life sentences in a federal penitentiary. Mm-hmm. So it struck me that here's somebody who was nice to me, who was a friendly guy, who is also a murderer.
Yeah.
And how do you deal with that? How am I supposed to feel about that? And asking myself that question is how was the seed of this book, actually.
Mm. Yeah.
And what leads Gus to say that at the end of the book?
Yeah. Well, it's really good. I really enjoy your writing, but I think you've really sort of hit your stride in a way with this Gus Murphy stuff, because I just really enjoy him. I assume you've got more books coming in the series?
Well, let's just say we're negotiating.
Oh, you're negotiating. Okay. So possibly more books in the series. That would be great. So we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it at that. This is Steve McElstrom speaking with Reed Farrell Coleman about his new Gus Murphy novel, What You Break. Reed Farrell Coleman, thanks for being on Right on Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Janice Post White, and all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our podcast found on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now stay tuned to Bonjour, Minnesota. ¶¶